Okay, so let us start the talk for today. And remember what I was talking about yesterday? Just, do you remember what day it is today? If you don't, I'll call the ambulance and take you away. Because sometimes that happens in retreat centers. I remember the monks over in UK. When they moved over there, there was this disciple. She was like a head clinical psychiatrist at a local place for people with emotional and mental health issues. And they told me that she'd managed to get a very huge, you know, but very inexpensive, big mansion in the village. And she said, it's a great place for doing a retreat. So she offered her place for a weekend retreat, now led by one of the monks, and so had all of these people just like you, you know, good meditators, went to her place for... Who laughed there? You are a good meditator. So had all the people come for the meditation, and like many people, it's like almost like a tradition in Sri Lanka is very strong, still held, sometimes in Thailand. When they come on a retreat and keep eight precepts, they wear white clothes from head to it's like an anagarika. And so everyone was wearing white clothes. And when it came to the walking meditation time, the only place they could do that was in the garden. And so you can imagine a weekend retreat in an English village. There's always these nosy, please excuse me, middle-aged women looking through the curtains. What's going on? What's happening? And as she was looking through the curtain, she saw all these people in white doing the walking meditation, lifting their foot very mindfully, walking forward. And you guessed it, what you could suspect happened actually did happen. She called the police and said the doctor has got her patients back, you know, from the hospital, and she's looking after them at the weekend in her house. Yeah, exactly. So the police came and a few vans to take all the meditators back to the the mental hospital. That actually happened. Of course, you know, a nice talk. No, these are not crazy people. Are you sure? What day of the week is it? I'm sure it's a Saturday. Okay, you're fine. And the other similar story happened here in Jhana Grove. It wasn't my retreat. I'm innocent. But they were doing one of the Vipassana retreats, and everybody was doing the slow walking meditation at the same time. So all around the compound, just lifting their feet, moving it forward, which is great. But then this family came and said, we won't make any noise. Can we please just have a look at your retreat center? We just want to have a look, but we'll keep very quiet, and we won't disturb anybody. And then after they'd been here, they came back to see me. I was still just talking to people after lunch. And their kid, a 6 or 7 year old kid, he was frantic. He said, Ajahn Brahm, you've got to get over to your retreat center. Something terrible's happening. I said, what? He said, zombies. The place has been taken over by zombies. They're all walking very stunned. Because apparently that's what zombies do. They walk really slow. And the last similar story, before I get on to the real talk, was when, over in Singapore, in one of the hospitals there, they asked me to actually, a little day-long seminar on like mental health and meditation. And one of the presenters, we're talking about Alzheimer's disease, dementia, you know, those sorts of issues. And so my job was actually to talk about, you know, if a person has it or how meditation works and all that sort of stuff. And then this doctor, you know, the professor at Singapore, you know, really highly thought after about being a great doctor, he was telling about just, well, look, what are some of the basic signs of, like, you know, Alzheimer's or, you know, getting dementia? How can you actually recognize it? He said, usually there's like three signs, he said. First of all is, you know, you can't remember the past. You know, you just, you let go of the past. The second is you don't plan for the future. And the third is you're socially disengaged. And I thought, oh, I got dementia. And I've been teaching people to get dementia for the last 45 years. Let go of the past. Live in the present. Have some quiet time for yourself. All three things I teach. But one is done intentionally. The other one is done, yeah, I've got a choice. So anyway, but back to the real inspiring you, hopefully. I'm just giving some information about what meditation is and how it works. And already, you know, in interviews, you know, some people come up and they say some really interesting things. And there's one part of meditation I said last night I was probably going to talk about, and I will, about nimittas, the beautiful lights in the mind. And no, that's nothing to laugh about. Actually, sometimes it is. I have to make my confession. I'll get the funny stuff out of the way first. Because nimitta, as you meditate, see these beautiful lights in the mind. And I did mention a little bit yesterday, whatever colour it is, more deep than the usual colours you ever see. And so there I was, I think, a couple of years ago, meditating in my cave during the rains retreat, and a nice meditation, and sitting down there, it's nice and dark, and it's peaceful, and just watching the breath, and delightful breath, and it's so peaceful, so nice. And then, as expected, you know, usually once the breath gets very soft and very joyful, and then the joy gets very strong, and then these lights come up in the mind. And the light I saw was this beautiful yellow. And I knew it was a nimitta because it's more intense, more clear than any yellow you would ever see in this world. More yellow than yellow. But it also had a shape to it. And that shape had some black lines on it as well. And when I looked at it, I recognized it immediately. It was an image, in the deep mind state, an image of Garfield the cat. I've been reading too many Garfield comics, and as soon as I recognized it, I burst out laughing, and that was the end of that meditation. The Garfield nimitta. That's very rare to have the Garfield nimitta. I'm the only one crazy enough to have had that. There was still a nimitta. I thought everything was there. It was just all that was happening is because I've been looking at a few of those cartoons. The image was in the mind, and that's how just the mind projected onto the beautiful light, and then that broke it all up. But anyway, it was a good experience. But anyway, what happens with those nimittas? It's part of the meditation. It happens naturally. Don't go looking for it. Don't try to make it happen. Otherwise, it will run away from you. And the story, the brilliant story from Ajahn Chah, concerns the experience of monks in that time when he was a young monk. We'd always, you know, they'd get their basic training in a monastery. And then they'd leave the monastery and go and live in the jungles, in the mountains, forest monasteries, live with other monks. It was really similar to the old tradition in Europe of when you had a trade like a blacksmith or iron worker or woodworker, you'd always, first of all, be an apprentice with a master. So you'd learn the basic trade with the master. You wouldn't get any payment at all for that. You'd just do chores. You get food, but no, it's pretty rough. And then after a few years, when you thought you knew the basic skills of that trade, then you become what they called a journeyman. So you go to other masters, learn other skills which your master never taught you. And then you go from here, you get a sort of some payment for that because you could actually produce things. And you go to this person, that person, you hear another really great woodworker over there, so you went to go and stay with them, until you learned just even more about your trade. And then eventually, when you finish being the journeyman, then you could be a master in your own shop. And then you could employ other journeymen and a few apprentices as well. It was just the way of training in those days, being an apprentice, a journeyman, and a master. And it's exactly the same in the Buddhist monastic tradition in Theravada. You have that the young novices and the young monks are called Nawaka. The young monks usually are up to 5 reigns. And after 5 reigns, then you go journeying around visiting other teachers or other places or the forests or the caves, the mountains, and seek some solitude to really get into your meditation. And you know you always got your master. If anything goes wrong, you can always go back and just ask a few questions or ask other teachers. But a lot of time spending in solitude. And usually after you've learned so much, then you can set up your own monastery, then you're your teacher. So that tradition is also in part of monastic life. So when Ajahn Chah was doing his wandering, as like a journeyman, if you like, a journey monk, that he would always try and find a quiet place in the evening where there was some water. The reason is because even when I was did my journey monk thing, just walking, that I always was taught by Ajahn Chah, this is our tradition, this is what you do. To find a lake or a river, maybe late in the evening, late in the afternoon, so you could wash any robes which were stinky, have a bathe yourself, and just filter some water for drinking, because that's all the water you had. And once you've done those basic necessities of life, then you put your mosquito net up, just maybe 15 meters away from the edge of the river, or just that's rough, depending on where there was a good place for it. And then you'd go in there for the evening. And Ajahn Chah said that sometimes that when he'd done all those chores, he would keep his eyes open in the evening, especially if the moon was up so he could see things. Because when he was sitting there in the evening, the twilight, that was when the animals would come out, because they needed to drink and to wash and to play. And to play is an important part of life. Animals do that, you can watch them. And so he would keep his eyes open. And he said often the animals would come out from the forest, from the jungle, close to the lake, and the first thing they would do is look around, but their eyes weren't really looking. The eyes of animals, even like kangaroos. The kangaroos can't see very well, but they can certainly hear and they can smell. But these are the jungle animals in the forest of Thailand. And they would look, they would sniff around, they would listen. And if they heard Ajahn Chah move or say anything, then they would realize there was a human being by that lake. And they would, even doesn't matter how thirsty they would go back and hide. Because again, the most dangerous animal on the planet is us, human beings. More tigers have been killed by humans than any humans killed by tigers. We're the most dangerous. So even though they were thirsty, they wouldn't dare come out. But of course, Ajahn Chah was a monk, a meditator, knew how to be still, knew how to just sit there with his eyes open and not move. To act like a statue. And so the animals would come out and they would listen. There was no sound or smell. So they'd come out, not just them, but with their family as well, with their little kids. And they would come out and wash and play by the pool in the jungle. Just like people see these days on those nature channels. Because this is just a camera which they don't sense is there. But this was a human being was watching, Ajahn Chah. And he could be so quiet, he could watch all these animals play around. It was a good entertainment in the evening for a monk. But he said sometimes he was really quiet and very still. And after the usual jungle animals would come out to play, then some very strange animals would come out. Animals which were incredibly beautiful. And his parents, his teachers, had never told him about those animals. They were incredibly shy. They'd come out, and if he just moved, they would sense that someone was there watching them. So he had to be really still. And when he was still, listen, and they would think there was no one there. So then they'd come out to play with their family and to wash and to drink, fearless, because Ajahn Chah was so still. And he said, those usual animals, they're just the normal states of meditation which come out when you're still. But those beautiful, rare animals, he said, that's like the nimittas and the jhanas, which come out to play on your still forest mind, the pool inside. They only come out if you're perfectly still. If like a nimitta comes out, yay, nimitta, woo-hoo-hoo, I've got to tell Ajahn Bum about this. That nimitta will run away, won't come out for days. Or if you say, it's a nimitta, okay, come on. I'm not going to say it. It will know. You have to be still. When you learn how to be still, like an Ajahn Chah sitting by a forest pool, then they do come out to play. And I, because I've been a monk for 45 years, I haven't seen these nature channels. But I do remember the story which I tell up in the mountains north of Chiang Mai by myself in my hut, summertime, not really summertime, hot season, hardly any water around, hadn't rained for days. So I put a little bowl out for the birds just outside my hut. And I was smart enough to put it just in the place outside my hut. I could be inside the hut, and through a knot hole in the wood, I could look to see what the birds would do. And it really surprised me. The sort of things you expect never happen. What you don't expect always happens. And what I never thought would ever happen was all these birds, after a few days, they found out where that water was, and they formed a queue. Thai lay people don't form queues for buses. But the birds did, and they were all different species. Big birds, small birds, coloured birds. Whoever got there first was first in queue, and the next one came and waited next, and then the third, the fourth, the fifth. And it was amazing to see that they weren't afraid of each other's species. They just were waiting patiently for the bird in front. And you know what they do. They go and drink and they jump in the water and they splash their wings around, get it nice and cool. And when they're finished, they fly away and the next one gets in. But then watching these birds the same time every afternoon have their bath and drink, getting in queue, there would always be every afternoon one of the most entertaining things to wait for. There would always be one bird who would actually jump the queue and just go in there while all the others were patiently waiting. What these birds then did, they got out of queue, they pecked this queue jumper to bits, bashed him up, and that queue jumper flew away. And after the queue jumper flew away, then they always got back in the queue exactly the same order they were there before. Their organization stunned me. How did they know where it was? How did they communicate with one another? But they knew. And that was the rule which they kept without needing any policemen or any written rules and regulations. So watching nature in the wild, we'll be okay, here we go. One of the other things which I saw there, which was really weird, and you know, sometimes you just see some very, very strange things in those jungles. This was very close to the border with Burma. But on this occasion, I was in my hut and just coming out of meditating, and something weird was happening. You know that sometimes you can feel like energy in the atmosphere is electric or there's something strange happening? So, because in the hut I couldn't see anything. The windows were all closed. But so I went outside my hut and had a look. And sometimes you wish, you know, that you had a camera or something. Because what you saw is almost every bird which was in that jungle was up in the air flying. Now you've seen these birds migrating, a group of birds. Imagine that covered the whole sky, and that's what was happening. And then there's these two enormous birds. And I remember seeing a king's eagle that was over in Norway, up in the mountains there. That was huge. It scared me because it was roosting. It was just standing there, and it was as tall as I was. And that was, I just very quietly turned around and went down the mountain. They could have just killed you so easily. But these were huge birds. I'd never seen anything so big. And I didn't, know what they were, except the thought came up, the king and queen of the bird population. It was only afterwards I looked at them and looked at carvings on the walls. Garudas they call them. And not the airline, the real Garudas. Garuda birds. And to actually see one, this is supposed to be mythological. But with your own eyes. And those are weird stuff, some of the stuff which you see in this world. But anyway, that's when you're in solitude and you go into these jungles and you're by yourself for days, but also you get fed every day. So anyway, that was in the jungles, the animals coming out. It's only when you're peaceful and calm and quiet they come out to play by the still forest pool. But that was Ajahn Chah's metaphor for how to meditate. You sit there really quietly. See what happens. See what comes out of the jungle. You don't go saying, Nimitta, I'm ready for you. Now come over here, please. Quick. I haven't got all day, You just wait quietly. When all the causes and conditions are in place, that's all you can do is just make the causes and conditions right so that you're peaceful, you're silent, you're still. Then these things come out to play in your mind. And the first amazing things which come out are these nimittas. And for those of you who want really detailed explanation, what I say, I might miss a few points. I wrote those all down in that book, the Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond book, the How to Meditate, basically, with those nimitta things. First thing which I would say about these nimittas, when they come, they're not that unusual. First of all, they're not that bright and beautiful. Just the ordinary animals coming out from the forest, but there's still lights in the mind. You're getting very peaceful. What are they, first of all? What it is, this is a reflection of your mind. Just like when you look in a mirror, you can see your face. This is in the mirror of mindfulness. You see your jitta, your mind. For those of you who know suttas, when the Buddha described Anapanasati Sutta, this was number 9, factor or stage, whatever you wish to call it, of the Anapanasati. You experience the jitta, the mind. And how you experience that is just you see these lights in the mind. I say lights, first of all, because the first nimittas which come up, if you do see a beautiful one, because you have got a beautiful mind, and often in retreats that happens because you're keeping precepts, you're doing the right thing, your duty, your chores, and you're trying your very best, you're being kind to yourself, being kind to others, keeping your precepts. And of course, your mind gets very beautiful. So when you see it, it's usually very powerful and very nice. But having said that, which is how I usually start, there was one fellow came up and said, Ajahn Brahm, I saw a nimitta, but it was dirty. It was like grubby, like a white piece of cloth which had all coffee stains and dirt stains and margarine stains and jam stains all over it. I said, yeah, exactly, that's because you've been misbehaving, haven't you? He said, I'm sorry, Ajahn Brahm. He's just a young man. Just messing around in Kuala Lumpur somewhere. If that ever happens, don't judge yourself. Because sometimes there's too many people judging yourself and just getting negative. What is being negative and judging yourself? It's just seeing the 2 bad bricks in the wall, or the 998 bad bricks in the wall, or the 9,998,998 bad bricks. There's always two good bricks in there somewhere. So look for the nice part of that, you know, nimitta. And that's an important point. That when you have like nimittas coming up, you're not enlightened beings. You have your faults and mistakes and say the wrong things and do the wrong things simply because, you know, you're not enlightened yet. And so don't be so hard on yourself. If you see a nimitta coming up and it's not as pure and beautiful and lovely, then there's always one part of it which is beautiful and lovely. So I told this fellow, look, it's like a dirty white cloth which should have been put in the washing machine a long time ago. But there it is in front of you. It always has some nice parts to it. Some parts of that cloth, for some reason or other, the coffee hasn't spilt on it. So have a look at that. Just zoom in. I used to say focus in, but zooming in is a much nicer word. Zoom in. As you zoom in onto that more clean, pure part, that part will sort of expand and fill up your whole vision. Because you're seeing this in your mind, not your eyes are closed. And if it zooms in, you get a more beautiful nimitta. And then you've got this beautiful nimitta, more beautiful nimitta. It's still not all that bright, but there's parts of it which are more bright than other parts. So you zoom into the brighter parts, the more beautiful parts. You keep zooming in like that. The more, most beautiful part of the 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 most beautiful part. And that becomes incredibly beautiful. You know, one problem people have is in meditation, they can't do that. They know that's what they're supposed to do, but they can't do that. And why? Because I don't deserve to be happy. I don't deserve to be enlightened. The crazy lack of self-worth which people have in this world. If you really understood the simile of the lotus, you see just how foolish that is. Yeah, the outermost petals of the lotus, those are the ones which have withstood the storms of your life, the difficult experiences you have had. No one has it easy. In fact, I always say, I told this last night, the storms and difficulties of your life, that's a fertilizer. On the outside, it looks all dirty and grubby and hopeless, but that's gone inside and created some incredible, beautiful perfumes in the innermost petals of your lotus. But don't worry about that. Just go inside. Zoom in. So for goodness sake, never think, I can't become enlightened. I'm not even a Buddhist. I'm a Muslim. I can't get enlightened. What a lot of go-mayang that is. Of course anyone can. You're a lotus. All that stuff on the outside is outside stuff, external stuff, the internal stuff. That's where the enlightenment is. So you just go in, zooming in. And as you zoom in, you know, to that coarser nimitta, dirty, it becomes pure and more wonderful. And what happens alongside this? The more pure and wonderful and brighter it gets, the more joy you have. This is gorgeous stuff, really happy. And so don't be afraid of the happiness. I say that because I was a victim of that. I thought to myself, first of all, if you're happy, you'll get attached. I better stop this. And I'm going to get attached to being, to meditating. But then again, my teachers, Ajahn Chah, said, carry on. And then everybody else was really getting into the meditation, so I wonder, what's wrong with this? And of course, then you saw in the word of the Buddha, in the suttas, so many times the Buddha said, do not be afraid of the joy which comes from meditation. And there's one sutta in particular, Pasadika Sutta, it's in the Digha Nikaya, where the Buddha was having this conversation with this young monk and say, if whenever you go out teaching, if people says, you Buddhist monks, you're attached to happy times or happiness. You say, well, what type of happiness? Because there's two types of happiness. There's a happiness born of the five senses and the happiness of the mind. The happiness of the five senses, no, Buddhist monks leave those. We don't get married, don't watch TVs. We don't, what else don't we do? I've been a monk for so long, I've forgotten what I don't do. But anyway, I think you understand that. But the pleasures of the mind, so yeah, we enjoy those. What do you mean? You enjoy pleasures of the mind? He said, yeah. The Buddha said, answer those people saying, yes, you're answering, oh, and then you're answering correctly. But won't you get attached to the pleasures of the mind? You say, yeah. Well, what will happen if you get attached and indulged in the pleasures of the mind, especially the pleasures of deep meditation? What's the consequence of enjoying your meditation? And the Buddha said, please answer them correctly, that if anyone really gets attached and indulges to the pleasures of the deep meditations, there's only four possibilities for you. Only four, not a fifth. One of these four has to happen if you get attached to meditating. Stream winning, so one. Once returning, non-returning, or full enlightenment. That's all. Not a bad deal, is it? So, when you actually see that, they go, wow, that's really clear. I love this Buddhism stuff. You really get into your meditation, enjoying it. Body vanishing, beautiful nimittas coming up, gorgeous stuff. Jhana's happening, wow. And then afterwards you feel so happy, so high. You think, you know, is this it? Not yet, but you're on the path. Something's going to happen. If you do this a lot, you're letting go so much, deep insights are happening. Whether you like it or not, you see the beauty in a lump of shit. And everything is just, wow, this is not supposed to be beautiful, but now it is. All my perceptions, all the things which define what I search for in life, and things which make me happy, things which make me sad, have I got them all right? And it changes a lot of perceptions about your life, about you, your mind, everything, your body. Being a man or woman, or being a monk or a nun, being old or young, all those identifications, they just evaporate. And then you start to get into these incredible wisdom states. And streamwinner, once returner, non-returner, arahat, that's what happens, according to the Buddha, if you indulge in these jhanas. Not a bad deal. But at this point, just to be honest, I have to tell you that there is a danger. Well, I don't know if you can call it a danger, but a consequence. If you do get lots and lots of jhanas, really get into this meditation, there's a very high chance of you losing your hair. And wearing a brown robe. Because this is where you fit in life. But anyway, so anyway, there you got your being very still. And these lights come up, and that's actually how you develop. Sometimes, though, these lights, whatever colour they are, sometimes a common experience is you're just on the edge. It's like you don't know really how to handle these things. So sometimes the nimitta might appear just in the corner of your vision. You're watching the delightful breath. There's a light up here somewhere. You know what that is, because Ajahn Brahm has told you there's a nimitta there. So you're watching the breath, the nimitta over there, and straight away you go looking for it. As soon as you go looking for it, it runs away. It's almost like that nimitta is testing you out. Are you really still a control freak? Wanting to actually to capture that nimitta and put it in a cage like many people do with animals? Or are you just going to just leave it? And be peaceful, be still, be in this moment, content, easy, satisfied, not wanting anything, just being here. You're watching the breath and it's like a light over there, wonderful. You don't want anything. You're happy if it just stays like this forever, or it just disappears back to the delightful breath. Even the delightful breath, if it really is a delightful breath, that's enough. I'm just so happy just watching my breath go in, and go out. This is all you ever want. You're fulfilled, satisfied. You don't want anything in the whole world, just being with this breath, coming in, going out. Ah, this is nice. I can do this for lifetimes, for eons. If you have that sort of attitude, then the nimitta comes up and says, this meditator is ready for me. And the nimitta will come and center itself. Don't you ever try centering nimittas. They don't belong to you. They're not your slave. You don't own them. They're visitors. You can welcome them in, but don't try and control them. You can say, nimitta, the door of my mind is open to you. You can come in if you wish. You can go out whenever you want. That type of letting go, freedom, is when the nimitta will come up. I have to say these things because these are powerful states of mind, and when people experience them, they will get excited, they want to control it. They've heard that, you know, you get enlightenment from these things, and so you just want them so much. This is not the sort of stuff which happens in the world. If you want a nice house, you have to work and pay for it. If you want an apartment or you want a car, you have to look for the right car and then save up and get some loans and all sorts of other stuff. It's so complicated. These things only happen when you're still. You don't want anything in the whole world. Happy, perfectly content. If they come, they come. If they don't come, they don't come. Really like that. I know some people say, Ajahn Brahma, I practice that. I mean, nothing happens. It's so disappointing. You haven't practiced it. You're sitting there saying, I'm going to let go, let go. I'm not going to do nothing, do nothing, do nothing. Come on. I can't do nothing all day. It's not doing nothing. It's a deal. You know, I will do nothing if a nimitta comes. And if a nimitta doesn't come, I'll tell Ajahn Brahma off and I'll ask for my money back. That's just so worldly. Now this is that you're just so happy, so peaceful, you let go, really still. And this is just you going deeper in to where you already were. You don't own these things, you're just going deeper in to this moment. In deep in this moment, of course, you don't want anything. Wanting needs a destination, needs an object, needs something you're going towards. And much of the wanting is just, well, actually all of it, is that needs a future. When you're really in the present moment, I mean really in the present moment, there's no future. It's just not in your perception anymore. So it's only this moment, of course, wanting dies there. And then just wait for a while and that develops. You just go into this moment, into this, and just into the now. In the center of the now, there's the O. N-O-W, in the center of the O is nothing, vacant space. In the center of space, what's in there? Nimittas. Center of nimittas, bliss. Center of bliss, ecstasy. The center of ecstasy, wow, you're just really getting into it now. So sometimes what happens is that you get so much energy and happiness, sometimes you feel afraid. I remember having this experience, and I was always really amused when somebody else came up afterwards and they asked me, Satish, I had this experience, I had this incredible nimitta, and it was just so joyful. And I thought, no human being can experience, can actually survive so much pleasure. And I said, yeah, I remember that time I had that experience. It was really cool. You know, having so much pleasure, it's an internal, mental pleasure that you thought you can't take anymore. The pleasure was just too intense, too powerful, too strong. But I got a great insight out of that. You can always take some more. Pleasure. And go for it. Have some fun in your life, in your meditating life. And when you do stuff like that, whoa, results are great. What was it that executive who came over from Sydney to do a retreat here, and she said in an interview she had to beg and grovel and bow and oh, just from her boss just to get the 5 days off, because you know the weekends, you know, weren't really important, but get Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday off work. Oh, she had to do so many deals to get permission for that, but eventually the boss gave in. She was just said, I'm going.
And so when she came here, when she went back, and obviously she was really stressed out when she first came, but she followed the advice, Ananda method. Take some naps. Relax. No schedules. When you wake up in the morning, then you get up. If it's too early, you go to bed. If it's too late, you miss your breakfast. Who cares? You can always get some bigger lunch. So whatever happened, she was just so relaxed. She, you know, followed. Probably because she was desperate. She had to do something. She was going crazy. She relaxed, relaxed, relaxed. And towards the middle of the retreat, she was really relaxed well. So she could start meditating. And the meditation got very good, very beautiful. And when she went back to work on a Monday, you know, she sent me an email from Sydney. So when I checked in with my boss, the first thing my boss said when I got into the office, what drug have they been giving you in Jhana Grove? I don't care what drug it is, but make sure next time you bring me back some as well. Because she looked so happy. And the only way that that boss thought that such happiness could be achieved or, you know, be there was through some chemicals. I said, no, just be meditating. Of course, the boss found that very hard to believe. You can get so high just through sitting down doing nothing. But anyway, so she became a very good advertisement for what's going on here. So little by little, you get very peaceful and these lights come up. Sometimes it's amazing, people's negativity. That's one of the reasons I tell jokes, funny stories, write books like Open the Door of Your Heart, bring up sort of some positive energy in you. Not just so you can see the positive lights in the nimitta, so you can focus on the good stuff, not worry about the bad stuff, the dirty stuff. But it's also that positive energy in you just allows, when the light comes up, to recognize it as a nimitta. And it's a teaching like this to lay people. I had great teachers with someone like an Ajahn Chah. But for you people, that whenever you see a nimitta, you always come up to me in interviews. I saw this light, but it can't be a nimitta, not me. And I said, what happened? And I said, okay, that was a nimitta, okay? 99% of the time when people see something and they ask me, is it a nimitta or is it not a nimitta? 99 out of 100 times, it certainly was a nimitta. So don't doubt yourself. But. The word I don't like the most, but. So it was. Give it the benefit of the doubt. Trust yourself. Why are we so bad view about ourselves? So, no, not me, I'm just a lay person. Like, well, why not? At the time of the Buddha, people, lay people got, you know, amazing things they could do. So, allow it to be an imitator. But say, no, it must be somebody shining a torch in my face. How many people bring a torch into this meditation room? I must be in the headlight of a car. Look where the windows are. You know that I designed this retreat center. They had another guy did all the drawings, but I changed them around. And I told him exactly what to do. One of the things I told him to do was actually to put the windows high. So you can't just look out a window and see the forest. If you want to watch the forest, get outside. Here is to watch your mind. So all the windows are high, so you can't see anything. And it's also, you can't see the sun shining in your face. It's not an imitator. That's what people say, it's the sun shining. So I know it was. Which way are you facing? Where was the sun? It wasn't. But nevertheless, people still have doubts. They've got their eyes closed. No, it can't be a nimitta, not me. So because of that, and I'll give gratitude where it's due. Where's it gone? I have these, courtesy of Singapore Airlines. They give you these if you ask for them. I always ask them if I need them or not. The eye shades. So you can put them over your... Here we go. This is new, I haven't used this at all. Put them over your eyes. So you can't see anything. You know it has to be a nimitta.
That's why I brought these out here. It's amazing how often that happens, just to make sure that you don't waste time just doubting, and instead you can have these beautiful experiences of meditation. So if you see a light, give it benefit of the doubt, it's an imitator. So then what do you do with it? The answer to that should be quite obvious. Nothing. Be mindful, be kind. You're opening up the lotus. So that's why sometimes people say, I see an imitator, but what should I do? Oh, come on. Have you not been listening to what I've been saying? Nothing. You're in the moment. No future. You're not trying to develop it and get somewhere. You're trying to be here. Oh, there's one, reminds me of one really important saying. Now, some of what Ajahn Chah taught me was just one-liners. So, you know, sometimes you couldn't write them in a book because they were just one sentence. But they were incredibly powerful teachings. And the teaching which I'm going to mention now was, you meditate to let go of things, not to gain things. You meditate to disappear, not to attain. So why are you meditating? You're trying to attain something? You hear me say about nimittas, brilliant bliss, and do you want that? That's what usual, that's what delusion does to you. Something nice, something wonderful, bliss, more bliss than you can sustain. You think you're going to explode with bliss. You can't take any more. That's pretty attractive marketing technique. But then people get frustrated. But it doesn't work. I can't get it. Of course you can't get it. You have to let go and disappear. Stop trying to attain things. Just be, and these things will come to you. The more you vanished, the more that you're wanting stuff, accumulating stuff, with all your list of possessions, all of your degrees. You know, this year, you know, I did get a master's from Cambridge, MA. Don't say why it's a master of arts. So don't give master of sciences. It's always, when I was there anyway, it's just such an old university. It was founded before science began. So they never actually just caught up with the progress, so it's always Master of Arts. Even there, you know, I was really had a big beard, a lot of hair, and they still had to call me Young Gentleman. Of all the students there, I was probably the least deserving of the title Young Gentleman. But anyway, when I was, what am I talking about now? I just, as soon as I mention those stories, I get all the other stories about his old life when I was a young student. I had one of my Cambridge friends came over here once, but I went to see him. I didn't pick him up from the airport. It was just too late at night, but I picked him up from a little hotel just by the airport and brought him to Jhana Grove here for a few days before we had our conference. It gave me the chance to talk personally to him, privately to him. And I said, you know, there's a lot of my disciples over here, a lot of my followers. They want to interview you and ask you what I was really like when I was at Cambridge. And if you tell them, I'll tell your wife what you were like when you were So we cut a deal, and so we were going to keep quiet. it wasn't that bad. At least that's what I'm saying. So anyway, where was I going with this? Oh yeah, nimittas, yeah, something to do with nimittas. Oh yeah, just to make sure that you give yourself the benefit of the doubt. And number two, to realize that these only come about by letting go, disappearing, vanishing. It's not something you attain. It's much better to look at it as like a default state. Ajahn Chah's, when the leaf isn't moving, is perfectly still. That's his natural default state. When there's no wind, for your mind, when it's not wanting anything. You don't want nimittas, you don't want enlightenment, you don't want anything in the whole world. You vanished. Disappeared. And that's bliss. The bliss you can feel. Whoa. You can't say whoa, because then it will disappear. But that's how it feels. Deep, deep peace. Incredible love. You don't need to change. Nothing is missing. don't have to strive for anything. This is not an attainment. It's all those attainments having vanished. You meditate not to attain things, but to disappear. And that, believe it or not, is bliss. Say believe it or not, because you'll experience that. It's one of the reasons why I keep talking like this. Ajahn Brahm, this is like monastic stuff. Why are you talking to us about nimittas? I can hardly even watch my breath. Yeah? I don't agree with you. Because one day that will happen. We don't know when. In fact, you don't know when. That's the nice thing about it. Totally unexpected. Sometimes I think, oh, this meditation doesn't work. I've had it. I've had enough. I can't meditate. I'm going to become a Christian. That's much more fun. You just need to pray. You can drink. You can eat any old time. And then all you need to do is to, you know, to pray to God and something. When you go, and all of your faults, anything wrong you do, you can just ask forgiveness. And then you go to heaven. Such an easy path, if it was true. But this, well, it's having to come here for a whole week. You know, if you're a Christian, it's only just, you know, for once a week, maybe, if you need to go to church. But anyway, this is always something about truth. After a while, you know, there's something in this meditation. You may not have got that deep yet, but nevertheless, you know that it's in the right way, in the right path. It sort of smells right. And so after a while, you get into some meditations. And, wow, it's happening. Don't ever say that. Wait, one of the advantages I had as a scientist, one of the things I learned, is when you do an experiment, you do the experiment, you take down the readings, but you don't think about, you know, the readings from the machines, the measurements. You don't think about them. You just write them down. You make your conclusions at the end of the experiment. Once all the information has been collected, then you work out what it means. Because if you work out what it means in the middle of the experiment, all the results afterwards, which is pointing in another direction, no, that can't be true. You don't even record them. It's an error. But this is how I was trained. A good teacher's there. When you're meditating, be quiet. Don't think, no insight or anything. When you're meditating, you're gaining the data, the raw material. Then afterwards, at the very end of the meditation, then you can contemplate it if you want. Explore it. What was it? Why was it? And I've already mentioned to a few people that maybe in one of the talks, if you do have a great meditation, don't go looking at what was there. Looking at what was missing. What vanished? What disappeared? You get far greater insights when you see what was absent rather than what was there. And you notice there were some things which were not there, which have always been there every moment of your life so far. In these deep meditations, they're gone. That is scary. If it wasn't for the bliss and the happiness, I can't see why anyone would ever do that, get into deep meditations. It's almost like the bliss allows you to let go a bit more. Let go of things which you are deeply attached to, which is scary if they disappear. But you're so blissed out, you only realize that afterwards they disappeared and you're having a wonderful time. So, this is what happens with those nimittas. Again, you don't control them. All of the things which I was saying about those nimittas is always telling you what not to do. Don't disturb the process. Hands off the steering wheel, feet off the pedal. Just career down, or in, or up, whichever way you think. And just enjoy the whole process. And when it comes, don't be afraid. It's perfectly safe. In fact, it's more than perfectly safe. I mentioned to you about that doctor who just tried to, you know, use a scalpel to cut somebody while they were in jhanas. couldn't do it. The knife wouldn't go through the flesh. I had told you when I was meditating with all those mosquitoes on me, the mosquitoes couldn't find me when I was in deep meditation. You had a natural immunity. And the other thing which I always noted, well, the scrub typhus, I was just, you know, too ill-informed, just starting off my path of meditation, but looking back, I'm pretty sure that that was when the fever broke. You get into a deep meditation like that, and diseases, I don't know why, that they just disappear. I've seen many people, their tumors vanish when they get into such deep meditation. All sorts of other incredible health benefits. Why? Because there's something magical, mystical about the nimittas and the jhanas which happen later. Very powerful, beautiful. But those powers cannot be misused, or very difficult to misuse them, because when you start misusing them, you take them as personal attainments, then they disappear, you can't achieve them anymore. Because they're not personal. Which is almost like a safety mechanism, which is nature. It's very self-protective. So after a while, that you can't get too much power from those nimittas because you can't keep the power. It's not personal, it's letting go, disappearing. The beautiful lights in your mind. Have a wonderful time just sitting here. And sometimes you might, okay, get the scary nimittas. I'm saying this because they're very unlikely, but I've had so many in my life, the nimittas, only once did I have a scary nimitta. It wasn't really scary, because I knew exactly, just similar to the Garfield nimitta, but you'll understand in a moment exactly why I said that. Because I was meditating, nice and peaceful, beautiful breath, just body just vanishing, and just the breath got so delightful, then an image came in my mind. And the image I saw, the nimitta I saw, was very complicated. It was a face. And then the eyes were like bulging out of its skull. Big eyes with blood on the outside. And its hair, this was actually it couldn't have been before the punks, before I knew about the punks, spiky hair. And it didn't have teeth, it had fangs, all sharp, like a vampire. And had necklace of skulls. What else did it have? I forget what, but really scary. And straight away, because I know how this mind works, that was one of those monsters you saw on the paintings in the Tibetan temples, like Kali. I was right, his tongue was coming out of his mouth. Was that scary? I'll try again. I don't think I can do it. Can I do scary? Was that convincing? No, okay. Need more practice. And I recognized straight away, oh, that's just because I saw Garfield Nimitta because I was reading too many Garfield, because I'd looked at these artistic representations from Buddhist cosmology. And that was what was in front of me. Ugh. So what do you do? Of course, I don't get scared. It's just image. So what I did, I put a hat, a nice straw hat, like people have when they walk in the sunny times to keep the skin cancer off your head. Just a nice hat on it with a flower on the outside, a nice effeminate flower on the top of the monster's head. And then I put Ray-Bans over its eyes, which were staring at me. So it looked really cool. And then I looked at its teeth, all sharp and dripping blood. So I decided to black a few of those teeth out, like it needed to see the monster dentist pretty urgently, and put a cigarette out of its mouth. And that's when the corners of the mouth, because when you're angry, I turned up. So it was like smiling. And then I forget what else I did, but this monster looked so ridiculous that I laughed, and it never came back to visit me ever again. That was, That was the end of the negative nimittas which come up. You create them, so you can mess around with them. So if you see sort of a really negative nimitta, have a play around with it. Turn it upside down, black out its teeth, you know, remove its nose or put a red nose on it, whatever it is. Don't look at the faults, look at the positive side. And you can find these negative nimittas can never harm you at all. But then, of course, you get the most beautiful nimittas, the simple lights. And the last thing I'm going to say about the nimittas, because I'm already going over time, as usual, I always like to keep traditions like going over time. And this was when, for a while, I had a problem. I got a beautiful nimitta, just gorgeous nimitta, but it was always moving. Not that much, but it kept moving. I just could not keep it stable enough to actually just to go inside and get to the jhanas. And I was wondering, why can't I keep this absolutely still? I'm trying to be still, but I can't get it still. And the simple reflection which gave me my answer to that problem was when I was just shaving in the morning, in the bathroom, in the mirror to make sure I don't cut myself. And then I just noticed the image in the mirror was moving. And just to prove the point, I held the mirror so the mirror couldn't move, but the image was still moving. You cannot keep the image still by holding the mirror still. The one that was looking had to be still. And then the image was still. Yeah, got it. So when I was, you know, the nimitta was moving, I was trying to hold the mirror still. I was trying to hold my mindfulness still. But no, instead of keeping the mindfulness still, this thing which was watching had to stop moving. When I stopped moving, the nimitta stopped moving. And after that, whoa, really good fun. Because then it gets brighter and brighter and brighter until it just sucks you in. And that becomes the realms of the jhanas, which will be explained another time, another place. We think the nimittas are fun. I think it was Ronald Reagan said, "You ain't seen nothing yet." Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And if anyone thinks this was too deep for them, they're way beyond you.